When I was in graduate school, two of my classmates, Stefano Della Vigna and Ulrike Melmendier, carried out a study on gym visits. They got data on three Boston gyms and analysed the attendance patterns of members. Dividing annual fees by the number of visits, they found that the typical gym member spent $17 per visit, even though casual visits cost only $10. In total, they found that the average gym member lost $600 compared with what they've just paid as a casual. The title of their paper? Paying Not to Go to the Gym. Over recent decades, the field of behavioural economics has taken off. Contrary to the assumptions of perfect rationality, full information, and a constant discount rate, economists have shown that we often make decisions that diverge from the standard model. A study of New York taxi drivers found that even though their hourly earnings are higher when it rains, they tend to go off shift earlier because they more quickly reach their target earnings for the night. Economists have shown that people are more likely to purchase a convertible if they test drive it on a sunny day, will pay more for a house with a swimming pool if the sale takes place in summer. Conversely, people are more likely to buy black cars on cloudy days and more likely to enrol in a university if they visit its campus on a cloudy day. Apparently, according to the psychologist, cloudiness increases the appeal of academic activities. Unsurprisingly, firms have become adept at exploiting our biases. Vacation timeshare exploits the fact that we tend to overestimate the flexibility we have in timing our holidays. Credit cards have low or zero annual fees, but high interest rates for those who pay late. Mobile phone plans have low upfront costs, but rates rise rapidly for those who exceed their caps. Relative to subscription prices, People magazine, a classic impulse purchase, is much more expensive on the newsstand than Foreign Affairs. Las Vegas hotels can only afford to underprice their rooms because gambling is addictive. In my recent book, The Economics of Just About Everything, I discussed some of the tricks you can use to subvert behavioural biases. If you're prone to overeating, use a small plate so it looks full. To avoid impulse purchases, only take cash when shopping. If you want to exercise more often, make a pact with a friend to train together. If you need to stop gambling, many clubs and casinos will allow you to self-ban. To quit smoking, try stickk.com, where you can make a contract with your future self, pledging that if you fail to kick the habit, your cash will go to a political cause you dislike. And incidentally, to any coalition voting smokers, please get in touch with me if you'd like to write a similar quit contract. Today I want to focus instead on the applications of behavioural economics to public policy, drawing on the work of economists Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler, the British Nudge Unit, and academic researchers. As I'll show, while the label behavioural policymaking is new, ideas from behavioural economics have been permeating Australian policymaking for some time already. But first, what is behavioural economics? After all, isn't all economics supposed to be about behaviour? Well, it's a bit too cute to call behavioural economics the love child of economics and psychology, but the definition does have something to recommend it. As well as acknowledging the intellectual lineage, most famously recognised by the award of the 2002 Nobel Prize in Economics to psychologist Daniel Kahneman, it also anticipates that, like psychology, behavioural economics is characterised by multiple themes rather than a fully coherent model. Among these themes are market inefficiencies, such as the mispricing of convertibles that I referred to above, framing, which suggests that the way a choice is presented can affect its uptake, and heuristics, in which people use rules of thumb to make decisions. A key insight of behavioural economics is that the trade-off between today and tomorrow tends to have a special status. There's nothing irrational about placing a slightly lower value on the future, but what behavioural economists have noted is that the one-day delay between today and tomorrow appears to be treated differently by most of us than other one-day delays. For example, when faced with a choice between $10 today or $11 tomorrow, many would opt for the former, choosing a dollar less in order to get the cash now. But when faced with a choice between $10 in 7 days' time or $11 in 8 days' time, almost everyone's willing to wait another day for $1 more. Another experiment asked people to choose between junk food and fruit to be collected in a week's time. Although half the participants chose fruit at the outset, two-thirds of them switched to junk food when it came time to pick up the meal. Similar results arise when asked to choose movies. When choosing for tonight, two-thirds opted for a lowbrow movie like Indecent Proposal. When choosing for 1 week's time, two-thirds opt for a highbrow movie like Three Colours Blue. What's important to note about this trade-off, known as hyperbolic discounting or time inconsistency, is that it suggests that policies which constrain our choices can make us better off over the lifetime. Without behavioural economics, we wouldn't set a compulsory school-leaving age, we wouldn't discourage teen pregnancy, and we wouldn't have cooling-off periods in major contracts. If you think such measures are a good idea, welcome to the Behavioural Economics Club. Perhaps the most important application of behavioural economics to public policy is in the area of retirement savings. The introduction of compulsory superannuation in 1992 was underpinned by the principle that, left alone, we tend to undersave for our retirement. Because of compound returns, setting a small share of our income aside during our working lives can guarantee that we maintain a good standard of living after we stop working. But we also have good evidence that prior to the era of compulsory superannuation, few people did so. Introduced at 3% in 1992, universal superannuation was planned by the Keating government to rise over time to 15%, but was paused by the Howard government at 9%. The Gillard government then scheduled it to rise from 9 to 12%. The process has begun and the compulsory rate now sits at 9.5%. The Abbott government's delayed the increase and appears likely to push the pause button at 9.5%. Unfortunately, we have evidence that 9.5% of earnings is insufficient to give most people a decent standard of living in their retirement, particularly if they take career breaks. Moreover, research by staff and the Reserve Bank of Australia has given the lie to those who argue that each dollar put into superannuation crowds out a dollar of private savings. The Coalition's decision to delay that increase might have been forgivable with a state of economic thought a generation ago, but not with what we know today. Since the early 90s, economists have also improved our understanding of how people respond to choice. The original model of superannuation was world-leading in terms of contributions, but carried with it overly ambitious expectations about the degree to which people would exercise choice. By mandating that people could choose their funds and requiring funds to offer multiple investment plans, people could theoretically select into the fund and plan that was best for them. But in practice, defaults prevailed. Most Australians are in the default plans and their default fund. Indeed, even when people switch, there's evidence they may not be doing it in the most prudent fashion. When the global financial crisis hit, 1 in 20 Australian superannuation investors switched their investment choices, with many switching from shares to cash just as the market bottomed out. As University of Western Australia finance professor Paul Gerrans notes, This meant a double hit from the declines experienced until that point, without the compensation of the subsequent market rebound. To address this, Labor created MySuper, superannuation plans that are low fee and easy to compare. To be named in a modern award, a superannuation fund will have to offer a MySuper product. This reflects the concern that higher fees often do not reflect better returns, and the need to make comparison easier. I know the Grattan Institute here has further ideas on how governments can reduce fees, and your informed contribution to this important discussion is greatly valued. Improving the quality of default superannuation products is vital for ensuring the system works well into the future. In the area of financial advice, Labor's future of financial advice reforms were also based on behavioural economics. In a perfectly rational world, financial advice customers would read every word of the fine print, effortlessly convert trailing commissions into net present value terms, and probably also use Bayesian analysis to downplay product advice where the advisor was receiving a commission. But in the real world, we know that many customers are unaware of the true cost of commissions, and that commissions have a tendency to skew recommendations from financial planners. That's why Labor's reforms encouraged more advisors to charge upfront fees, which tend to be cheaper for consumers. In the United Kingdom, the Behavioural Insights team, commonly known as the Nudge Unit, has had success applying behavioural economics to encouraging people to pay their taxes and fines. In one experiment, 100,000 Britons with overdue tax bills were randomly assigned to one of four letters. One, the standard letter. Another, a letter which pointed out that taxes funded healthcare and roads. Third, a letter which noted that 90% of people pay their tax on time. And fourth, a letter which noted that the recipient was in the minority in not paying on time. Relative to the standard letter, the second and third letters raised payments 1-2%, while the fourth, which reminded the recipient that non-payers are in the minority, raised payment rates by 5%. In Britain, smarter enforcement letters are saving the government tens of millions of pounds as a result. Similar work by the Nudge Unit found that people who were late in paying their car registration fees were three times as likely to pay up when the enforcement notice carried a photo of the vehicle and the caption, "Pay your tax or lose your car." Another experiment used personalised text messages to encourage people to pay their fines on time. The trial yielded the government $30 million in savings, not merely from additional revenue, but also from reduced use of bailiffs. Not a bad return on investment, given that the British Nudge Unit costs around £500,000 a year to run. In New South Wales, a newly established Nudge Unit is leading to the revamp of land tax and speeding notices. Behavioural economics isn't just about payments. The British Nudge Unit has also had success in health interventions. One experiment found that patients who filled in their own appointment cards were nearly one-third less likely to miss the next doctor's appointment. So how could behavioural economics affect policymaking in future? Let me suggest half a dozen ways. One, the power of free. A classic behavioural economics experiment offered people an expensive lint truffle for 15 cents versus a cheap Hershey's Kiss for 1 cent. 73% went for the expensive truffle. And the authors dropped both prices by 1 cent, making the truffles 14 cents and the cheap chocolates free. Now, 69% went with the cheap chocolates. This result helps explain why an experiment in Africa found significantly higher take-up rates for free malaria prevention bed nets than for those sold at a subsidised low price. If policymakers want to encourage something, there's a considerable advantage in making it free. Two, framing. When the global financial crisis hit, Both the United States under President Bush and Australia under Prime Minister Rudd provided household payments in an attempt to bolster demand. Subsequent surveys found that the share of Australian recipients who spent those payments was up to twice as high as it was in the United States. One possible explanation is that the Australian payment was described as a bonus, while the US one was as a rebate. Similarly, payments to organ donors have been found to be more politically acceptable if described as defraying costs than as compensation. 3. Defaults matter. A laboratory experiment on organ donation randomly assigned people to one of three conditions: required to choose donor or non-donor, default donor, or default non-donor. When made to choose, 79% wanted to be a donor. We can think of that as the underlying share who wanted to donate their organs. But when the researchers changed the default to donor, it raised it to 82%. When they changed the default to non-donor, they dropped the donor share to 42%. Across European nations, those with opt-out donation schemes have higher organ donation rates than nations with opt-in schemes. Although organ donation is complex for other reasons, these findings point to how much inertia matters. Given that many of us still have our mobile phone ringtone on the factory setting, we probably want to think carefully about defaults when designing policies. 4. Losses are valued more highly than gains. One of the simplest economic experiments you can do in a classroom involves handing out chocolate bars and mugs to alternate students, and then asking, who'd like to switch? Now, if losses and gains were equally valued, then half the students should want to switch. The standard finding is that very few want to exchange their gift for the alternative. In other contexts, the endowment effect is even stronger. A study at basketball mad Duke University found that students were willing to pay $170 for basketball tickets on the black market. But if they were given tickets, they insisted on $2,400 to part with them. One literature survey found that the typical person values losses 2.6 times as highly as gains. This explains why the pain involved in recouping a $1,000 government overpayment tends to be larger than the pleasure that accompanies an extra $1,000 payment. One policy that exploits the loss-gain asymmetry is Save More Tomorrow, which allows US workers to commit to putting their next pay rise into savings, thereby gaining higher savings in the future without suffering wage losses today. 5. Make the information simple. One of the reasons that the previous federal government devoted considerable energy to creating the My School, My Child, My Hospitals, and My Universities websites was to simplify the process of choosing. The creation of these sites didn't just democratise information, previously only available to insiders. It also brought together information previously scattered across multiple sources. Behavioural economics recognises that people are time constrained, so it helps to make choosing as simple as possible. 6. Randomise. A key feature of each of these studies is that they're based on randomised policy trials, testing new policy interventions in the same way we require pharmaceuticals to be tested before providing them with a government subsidy. Randomised policy trials are underutilised in Australia and are a valuable way to test new policy ideas, behavioural or non-behavioural. A common critique of behavioural economics is that it is paternalistic. This misses the fact that governments have to set defaults, send out fine notices, and choose a form of words to describe their policies. Governments already do plenty of pilots. The difference between a randomized trial and a pilot is that a randomized trial includes a credible control group. In many cases, behavioral economics involves tweaking something the government's doing already, without narrowing the choices available to people. Behavioral economics isn't a panacea for all our ills. Indeed, the very notion of behavioral economics is that grand visions often founder when faced with the messy complexity of human behaviour. As Harvard's Danny Roderick once put it, the world is better served by syncretic economists and policymakers who can hold multiple ideas in their heads, by one-handed economists who promote one big idea, regardless of context. For a good behavioural economics policymaker, these multiple ideas include considering the power of free items and ensuring choices are carefully framed. Such a policymaker thinks hard about the right defaults and takes account of the fact that people weigh losses more highly than gains. The behavioural economics policymaker looks to provide more information as simply as possible and test policies via randomised trials. But enough of all that tweaking. It's looking cloudy outside. Anyone for a black car and a university degree?